Imagine, if you will, the flavor of a cabbage. You got it, right? It's, you know, not the most distinctive flavor in the world, but you know it. Okay, now what if I told you that a scientist did an experiment where he fed people a cabbage-flavored jelly and only 1 in 20 people could recognize it? That's one way to gauge how important texture is in our food. If you change the texture of something, everything changes. Well, that scientist, Ole Moritzen, has a new book called Mouthfeel: How Texture Makes Taste. Our contributor Russ Parsons talked with Ole to find out more.
Ole Moritzen, welcome to Splendid Table.
Thank you very much.
Now, when we think about food and cooking, we mainly think about tastes and aromas. But as you point out in your book, there's an equally important aspect called mouthfeel. What exactly do you mean when you say mouthfeel?
Well, mouthfeel is the sort of the technical term. We also sometimes call it texture. It's a technical term that refers to the sensation of touch and feeling. And I mean, most people, when they say taste, they really don't mean taste that is what is technically on the tongue. It's just as much in the nose or in the ears, on the eyes, and also very much in the feeling in the mouth. And usually we don't think about it unless it's contrary to what we expect. Suppose we get something which is supposed to be crisp and it's soggy, or we get a piece of meat and it turns out to be chewy and not tender, then we actually notice it. But in most cases, we don't even have a word for it. So I suppose the word mouthfeel is not even a common word, but it's very important for the entire taste experience.
Now, in the book, you point out that the Japanese have 400 words to describe the texture of food, but we in America have only 80 or so.
That's right.
And the Japanese even have 3 different words for mouthfeel itself. How do you think this is reflected in their cuisine?
I think it reflects, first of all, of course, that the Japanese, they are very observant as to this particular feature of the food. For instance, if you have fish in Japan, you'll see that they pay great attention to the actual texture of the fish. Most fish don't have much taste and flavor, but it's actually the texture that makes it different from one kind of preparation to the next. And there's one thing in the classical Japanese cuisine which I'm very interested in at the moment, and that's the particular way you treat vegetables. There's a technique called skemono, which basically means pickle things. And most of us who have had a Japanese meal will see that you have these little side dishes. It could be cucumber or eggplant or daikon, and they are marinated, and they have different kind of colors, different kind of flavors. And sometimes if you touch them with your fingers, you think they're not very interesting because they're sort of flexible. But once you get them in the mouth, you basically have a crunchy feeling all over your skull. And that shows that the Japanese have extreme attention to the mouthfeel. I'm also quite fascinated by seaweeds. And seaweeds is only something that is gradually coming into the Western cuisine. But in Asia and in Japan in particular, seaweeds are very common, something you eat every day. And I'm pretty sure that the Japanese do, not only because you have it as a tradition, but you also eat it because it has interesting texture. It can be chewy, it can be slimy, it can be crunchy. And the different kinds of preparations, for instance, in a miso soup or in a seaweed salad, it all reflects a deep attention to the feeling in the mouth, much less than the actual taste and aroma, because seaweeds don't have much taste of their own.
Now, you also point out in the book that in a blind test of pureed foods, most people could only identify 30 to 40% of them by taste alone. So texture is so important. Which foods were easiest and which were hardest to recognize for people? And why is the texture of that food so important?
One of the most successful experiments we do with the public is to prepare a jelly made out of various kinds of cabbages. It's only about 5% who can actually recognize it. So that usually is a big surprise because you can not recognize it from the taste alone. You're actually using the feeling in the mouth. Tomatoes is more about 50% who can recognize it. And then there are other things like various kinds of meats you can actually more easily identify. But generally, it is very difficult if you remove the original mouthfeel.
At the same time, you included an experiment for making ketchup where you used identical ingredients, but you processed them differently so that one was perfectly smooth and the other was coarse and chunky. And you found that the flavors were remarkably different.
Well, it's not the flavors that are different. It is the mouthfeel that is different. To the extent that you would say the flavor is different is possibly because the release of the aroma compounds may be different when you have to chew and when you don't have to chew. But in principle, since it is made of exactly the same things, it has the same taste and also the same aroma. But the way it feels in the mouth, it's very different. So acceptance of mouthfeel is very dependent on your expectations and your previous experiences. And expectations are also quite dependent on your culture, the way you're brought up. And that's what makes, I think, the whole perception of taste so exciting, because it's not only physiology. It's just as much your upbringing, your culture, your tradition, and your expectations.
Creaminess, as you point out, seems to be a special case. It's a texture, technically, but it's one in which all of our senses combine. Can you describe what's going on?
It's something that I think it's not known in detail. One of the important aspects of creaminess is that it has to flow in a certain way in the mouth. And if you take, for instance, a mayonnaise, we think that the reason why a mayonnaise is feeling creamy is because that the oil droplets have to be a particular size such that they're basically like sort of ball bearings in your mouth. It makes it sort of feel very smooth. And if the droplets of oil is too big, it'll feel oily, even though it has the same amount of oil as a proper mayonnaise. So it's a matter of the sizes of the droplets, the way it sort of flows in the mouth, and also the way it sort of clings to the surfaces in the mouth.
You pointed out in the book that there are certain aromas that emphasize the feeling of creaminess, such as vanilla.
Yeah, that's, I think, something that most people know, that if you add a vanilla flavor, you feel it's more creamy, even though it may not be. It's something that is related to sort of the experience you have earlier, and we call it binding. I mean, a lot of the talk nowadays, certainly, about taste is sort of interpreted by processes in the brain. And there's even a new field of science called neurogastronomy that sort of tries to reflect on the neural process related to the way you perceive food. And quite often in the brain, we bind different things together. That is, that if we have an experience of vanilla and creaminess belongs together, and then if we meet vanilla in another context, then we tend to interpret it in the sense that it's creamy, even though it may be less creamy than it actually is. It's sort of a similar story, as I said before, that previous experiences and expectations sort of frames the way we experience the taste of food.
The book is wonderful. Ole Moritzen, thank you so much for being on Splendid Table.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Ole Moritzen is author of Mouthfeel, How Texture Makes Taste. Russ Parsons is author of How to Pick a Peach, and Ole left us with a recipe for caramelized potatoes, and another one with a terrific name. He calls it Vegetables Prepared So That Children Will Love Them. And you can find them at splendidtable.org.